India.
Colonization.
Yeah.
I think my question is broader than that. Beyond the Portuguese, you had the British and the French in India.
Later.
So do we know to what, how, you know, whatever paintings were brought by the British and by the French to India, what influence did these have on the art of India?
That's a fascinating topic to think about. So, first of all, the Jesuits, not only that they were part of the Portuguese colony there, they were working as spies at the court, if you want to put it in very crude ways. I mean, they were sending constant reports about what was happening, what was going on, who was coming and going, what is the mood, what is the deals that are being struck, whatever information that they could get, they were reporting back. So yes, they are missionaries, but they were used as, you know, regular diplomats. And I think it was a really interesting choice. And whose choice exactly it was, that's something that scholars are still arguing about, to send the Jesuits as those kind of diplomats into Akbar's court. Because in Mughal sources, you read that Akbar actually requests them. He sends a letter and he requests the Jesuits. But then if you look at European materials, then the decision then to, you know, put them in contact with Akbar earlier on in a different kind of location was also something that was conscious. So it's an interesting idea, but that they served as diplomats and, you know, in every possible way, yes, definitely yes. About the others, so it's very hard to find actual European material that is still in India from that period, or to identify specifically actual objects that we know were made all this way through from Europe to the subcontinent. These are difficult traces or routes to follow. So we are left with these kind of hypotheses of what we see in the Mughal paintings that might tell us what was brought to the court. And then the question of who brought it stays kind of opaque and in most cases unknown, unless we have in primary sources or some kind of a marked object that could tell us that this was brought by this and that. So it's still a problem.
And the English, and I mean, they come much later.
Yeah.
So and they you know, and there is an impact, but that's way later in the 18th, 19th century.
Yeah.
Sorry, you had a question.
It's actually related to the British. I was wondering if you think the reflections that the British could see from the Renaissance art movement, or is into the Mughal art, built their obsession kind of with the Mughal art that they had when they were colonizing?
I think that question should be answered by Kristen here.
Yes, they definitely were.
And I think they did. If you just look at the collections, and if you want to study the Mughals, the first place you need to go is England, right? So you can understand that there was a great obsession, right, in every possible way. They collected everything they could, but and also triggered all kinds of other interactions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I jump on?
Yeah.
You mentioned my name, can I just ask a question? So I was sort of interested in this idea of copying and acknowledging that the kind of copies we see are not about subject matter, but are about facture or about style, maybe. I'm curious to know from your perspective, when I think of Indian painting, the history of Indian painting, I think of how central the practice of copying is, right? Even, you know, Arthashastra is sort of the idea that to copy is to show your skill and also sort of as an homage to your teacher. Do you think that these practices of copying is coming more from the artists or from the patrons, or do you see that this kind of copying as something that is sort of newly being articulated in Mughal sources, different, distinct from your earlier practices?
Wow. So I'll start with the easiest one, whether it's the artist or the patron. I think it depends on the circumstances. So in some cases we have inscriptions, for example, the camel fight that we have. Some inscriptions tell us that Jahangir asked one of his artists to copy an image that was at the Mughal collection that was made by Behzad, one of the big names in Persian paintings. So that was a specific request from an emperor to an artist. But then I think that in other cases, it has to do with the kind of tradition and innovation that, and also the competition among artists, right? That occurs at the court and in these kind of environments, to show skill, not necessarily to show a connection to a direct teacher, but in what kind of lineage do you want to insert yourself in terms of your artistic traditions and artistic abilities. So it is interesting then to see that they are referring back to the one of the most famous painters of Sultan Hussein Baykara, the Timurids, and working a lot with these kind of materials when they're creating their own versions of Timurid materials as well. So I think there's all, it really based on those specific ones, and I don't remember what was the last.
Yeah, that was around.
Okay. Okay, I have another question. Okay. Sorry, and I've been dying to ask you this. Many of the sources always sort of speak of female artists, and whether it's at the Ottoman court, whether it's at the Safavid courts, or the Mughal courts, which were sort of also going on at the same time. But whereas we don't have any works by women, or not too many, from Iran or Ottoman Turkey, we do have them from Mughal India. And actually, what is wonderful again about Mika's book, that she actually uses these women and she makes them case studies. So it's very exciting to have these women actually and their work highlighted, and they are terrific.
Amazing.
So it's not that it's like, it's a woman, she can paint, isn't that great, we're going to include it. I mean, they're as good if not better than the men.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about the women?
So that one of the privileges, I think, of working with the Mughal material is that you also have very strong female artists that we have records of, and we actually have their paintings that I use in the book. But I also wanted to show, not this one. So this is one of the paintings that I use in the book. It's made by an artist called Mimi. We don't know much about her, but her pictorial abilities are just tremendous, incredible. This one is made by another female artist, Nadira Banu, and we have also Sahifa Banu that we have seen earlier, and Rukaya Banu, and so we have really a group of very active female artists that are competing with a man producing works that are collected by the royal ateliers in the same way that they would collect any other work. So in that respect, it's tremendous. And that is my next project, actually. So the next book is going to deal with female patronage, depictions of women, and the women artists at the Mughal courts in those periods. So whatever did not get into that, to this book is going to go into the other one. So,
obviously, the Islamic kind of injunction against portrayal of human beings is not respected yet in Mughal India. Is there any reason or rationale for how did the Mughal emperors get around? Or did they have religious leaders who kind of did not have power or had different sets of beliefs?
So we have to, so in, if we can talk about the Muslim world as one entity for a second, then we can think about the fact that really in the Quran there is nothing that tells you not to make portraits or paintings of figures. What you cannot do is make idols. And so it's not about the image itself, it's how you use it. Right, so there is usually a kind of, scholars agree that there is usually this kind of dichotomy between very specific religious spaces or contexts in which images would not appear, like a mosque, but I can show you also that this is not the case, or in Quranic texts, usually you would not find figural representations, although the Mughals have a Quran page that has images of people praying all around it. So I don't know what that means. So the idea more is what you do with the images and not and where they are, right? And not exactly with the idea of no figural representation.
How could it be the Hindu influence? Because you do have the notion of saints and so on in India.
You have it in Islam from day one.
Yeah, you have it actually. The earliest surviving images, pictorial images, are actually from the Arab world.
Yeah, on coins.
And they're on coins, they're in bathhouses, we have naked women, we have it all.
Yeah.
And the one notion is always that, oh, it was those Mughals and the effete Persians who did figures and the Arabs and nobody else did figures, which is a fallacy. The one thing is you didn't necessarily, I mean, there are always exceptions as we know, that there are no figural representations within a religious context, but within a private context, like, you know, these manuscripts were done for private patrons, they weren't used for religious purposes by any means. So within that context, you did have figural imagery, and you had it in the Arab world as well, right from the beginning of Islam.
Yeah, it's just that today there is different propaganda about that. So,
yeah, and things. Yeah, I mean, we learn different things, but when you look at the evidence, the visual evidence, there's definitely figures are there. So. Okay. All right. Ah, last one.
A quick one. Why is the Latin still included, or is that common, or was that part of sort of the intellectual culture of princes, or were they being educated in Latin as well as the other languages?
Very good observation. So it's unclear to me, because in this one, all the images that I've shown you except this, I have seen the originals. So, and this one is the only one, because it's in the Gulistan library in Tehran, and so that's not going to happen anytime soon. I'm going to see this image. So it is unclear to me whether this is a European print that is colored, or that this is that she is actually incorporating that text as part of the image to relate to it, to the entire composition. I don't know yet. Here definitely there is no, so there in the European print there is a text in Latin here that the artist of course chose not to include and not to copy, and instead there is a poetry by Emir Khosrow Dehlavi that serves as a kind of a connection to the image. So I don't know yet, but I hope someone will figure this out.
Okay. I think, will you join me to congratulate Mika? And thank you all for coming. I'm just like, I know I'm asking questions. Wow, that's
It's a little bit hard.
So you scrabble the region.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
But thanks for coming.
It's great seeing you.
You too.
And it was so good to hear about your work. It was so interesting.
Thank you.
And the next project sounds interesting too. The women?
Yes.
And the same time period.
Yes, the same time period. Yes. I'm going to start working on it. So I have to look at their ancestors, the Mongols and the Timurids. So that has been already. I didn't know, but there wasn't.
You have to go back to the
field. Yes.
No crisis. So.
That's good.
Yeah. I submitted the LOI, so I'll set up a time for us to meet and talk about it. We're going to meet with Sunroom. So she was saying she was excited that I told her we were going to do this. And we're going to meet with her just to get a sense of, you know, what they're doing. She said they have an upcoming. There's an upcoming. Allison is very well connected to teachers. And you both
are very smart.
Very smart.
we'll have to think about that and talk to them. They can,
I know. Yeah.
One of the problems they have is that their storage area.
I know. And just seeing the real thing.
Who is the genius
Well, you know they're trying to move people out there.
Oh yeah, how's that going?
Should probably turn this off.
I don't want to.